It was a couple of years ago now, I reckon, that when I was dissecting a chicken wing, as you do, in front of a class, in order to show them the general direction of where to go without giving too many instructions, just having a look at what you're doing and where to go, I made an idle remark off the cuff that thank goodness we're not here 63 million years ago, when there were 3-meter-tall giant chickens as the top predator ruling the earth, because we might have one stick their head in the window and cause us some grief. And this unleashed a lot of questions. This is Peter Hill Explains, where I discuss sort of random facts about birds as a way of saying, hey, look, the structured way into a field of knowledge can often leave some interest, or the general excitement about, or the general sorry, nuances about a topic to see what's a learning experience, what's strange, what you should notice aside. So getting back to it, the 64 million years ago, a giant meteor, we believe, hit around the Gulf of Mexico, a large meteor, and as far as we know, it hit in a deposit of gypsum, which is calcium sulfate, and that showered the world with sulfur dioxide, acid rain, but also a thick cloud, which meant the world simultaneously initially burnt and then froze. And this, we believe, killed off all the dinosaurs. And that's just sort of a random fact, going from the bird to killing off the dinosaurs. And so the first dinosaur which survived, the only dinosaurs which survived, were the birds. In fact, the birds are now understood, or are, dinosaurs. The dinosaurs didn't go extinct. At least one species of dinosaurs survived to the present time, and they're the branch of dinosaurs called birds. They had sufficient, I suppose, mobility or whatever it was to survive, and so there are some bird species, I believe, just off the top of my head. I think penguins evolved 80 million years ago, so they evolved before the impact. And I suppose the overall question is that we can actually tell the age of an animal from its DNA. The amount of time it's been evolving for is stored as a certain little bit of a clock, so you can pick up an animal and you can see how old it is. And in case of humans, you can see how long we've been evolving for, and whether we have crossbred or interbred with other human, I suppose, races like Neanderthals and Denisovan and yet another unknown races, because they're big chunks of our DNA, which are distinctively more complex, more evolved. So if we've had I think the word is a liaison. These are all general information to get through, but we're going back to birds. These are the giant birds, and it wasn't long before people got YouTubes up and were able to check on their phones and Google that, in fact, yes, what happened is the dinosaurs went extinct, and the first thing to fill that niche were these giant mega death birds, which used to go around the place, grown to enormous size. I believe, obviously, flightless. One of the things, I think pterodactyls are not birds. They're sort of closer in terms of our world to bats, which often gets us into the point, just following up random things, that birds are not the only species that fly, and that the actual evolutionary niche of birds is the air can actually be occupied by bats. But birds, are they warm-blooded? Yes, indeed, they're somewhere between warm-blooded and the full mammalian warm-blooded. So yeah, you've got warm-blooded dinosaurs, you've got birds, allegedly warm-blooded. The important thing is having fur, and warmth allows you to fly at night if you're a bat. on that night, you have the problem of seeing where you're going. So you have echolocation, which are not necessarily developed in birds. Of course, birds have the requirement to have different sight requirements, and so eagles have special telescopic binocular vision, magnified vision, which allows them to see their prey at a greater distance. I'm just going off the top of my head. Different birds have, say, for instance, ducks have a specialized vision that allows them to see the different colors of green, so they can land and near water, which is sort of obscured by vegetation. They can see naturally detect radiation. Detect different colors. Well, birds can also detect polarized light that they have discovered. And this is important that when the sun is obscured, they can actually develop a sense of orientation by looking at Polaroid sunglasses. So if you put Polaroid sunglasses on and look at the sky, you can see that 90 degrees away from the sun, it's very, very dark, so you can work out where things are. So this is again from a single point expanding up. There's lots of things about sight on the having the eyes on the two sides of the head. But if you're a hunting bird, like an owl, you have the eyes in the front of the head, and then the owl's face, the shaping of the feathers on the face, is more acoustics to allow the owl to follow the sound forward. So the flatness of an owl's face is an acoustic point, and owls and birds that swoop their food, like kookaburras, have special, I suppose, feathers there. They have a wing shape which doesn't make any sound as they're flying through to allow them to land and take up their food. And of course, owls and birds are adapted to flight, so they have to do various things to gain a reduction in their weight, so their bones are generally hollow. So you can actually break and observe chicken bones. And look, there was a case here that I got, even with gloves, someone to actually break a chicken bone, and their chicken bone cut them. Investigation on that one. So we'll just have to think about how to do that one. This is an example. This is part of exploring things to explore chickens. This is one of those examples of you think everything's safe, but you just have to be so careful in getting things going. I had reported everything and done a process with chicken bones. So we've got the chicken bones and things like that. Another thing to actually make the birds light is only having one hole for pooing, for eggs, and for urination. And so bird poo, when it lands on you, is a combination of the poo and the urine. Bird poo is guano, and it's a large source of nitrogen because the birds eat small insects and fish, which contain protein, and the protein gets broken down into nitrogen. You create basically your urine is fertilizer because it has uric acid, which is a breakdown of the amino acid in which forms up your protein. It's a general soluble, water soluble thing. Obviously, it has to be soluble because it's got to dissolve in your water and produce this uric acid in your urine. One of the important things is that you don't urinate out proteins, and of course, there are these detections of any protein in your urine to make sure that you're not. The protein is a strong source of energy, and so is the uric acid, and so is the guano. All of which, the uric acid and the guano bird poo, is used for making explosives in war and in fertilizers. So we've covered the uric acid, and bird poo. Interestingly, that when eggs come out, farm eggs come out, and again, people don't know this, that they're covered in poo. And so often when you do, often children have only ever had eggs from a supermarket, eggs, free range eggs, you have to actually leave the poo on them. And before you're ready to use them, you have to actually go and wipe the poo off. And of course, so from time to time we get given free range eggs, but my wife says that the poo wiping off. I'm just trying to think of the various products before the war, when people got their eggs in general, they had to actually. So chickens don't lay their eggs all year round. In fact, chickens only lay their eggs. They're good laying eggs for about two or three seasons, and then after that, they're pets. They don't produce as many eggs. So there's a youthful egg generation thing, and there's a egg free time where they're molting, and during that there's no eggs produced. But if you're living off a continual supply of eggs, you have to have a way of preserving eggs. And the way that you preserved eggs was a product, and I think it was Egg Save, something along those terms. A particular product was now gone from our consciousness. And I really wonder what it was, but it was a particular thing that you coat the eggs and store the eggs away. You'd store the eggs away to survive. I can't remember whether it's winter months. When chickens don't lay eggs, and of course, having preserved eggs, you do have the problem of rotten eggs, and rotten eggs smell. I think they float rather than sink, and they smell of sulfur dioxide due to the sulfur bonds in the large number of sulfur bonds in the egg white globular. So a lot of the molecules inside an egg are globular molecules, and when you heat up the egg molecules align and become they bond. And it's interesting that the bonding of egg white is restructuring of the proteins, and of course why they go long and denurtured is their sulfur bonds recapture each other. So this is your egg fart, that sulfurous egg fart that someone does, is the smell of eggs. If you look in eggs themselves, they have a small little inner membrane, which is they're basically a cell membrane, but the cell membrane doesn't go around the full length of the egg because it's needs a little air sac. So there's a little air sac in there, and the egg surface is permeable, so the actual egg relatively waterproof, but it can actually breathe through the surface of the egg. And if you were to take the egg out and take a small shell and look under electron microscope, Q for electron microscope egg, you'll see that there are fine fibers. In fact, that's how eggs are made. There's these cells which produce these tiny little worms of egg material. I suppose it would be calcium phosphate. I'd be interested to do a few chemical reactions with it. We know it is some sort of calcium salt, because eggs shells will dissolve in water. In vinegar, so you can actually dissolve your eggshell away and get your inner membrane. Or you can crack the shell off, but you have to be very careful because there's small, something which we'll examine, is ligaments connecting the egg skin, or the egg outer membrane, with the shell. But again, if you look at under the microscope, it's sort of, it looks like underfelt, sort of this matted cross-woven spaghetti. It's hard to describe it, but it is porous to oxygen, and so essentially the small chicken can be inside. I suppose the important thing is that dinosaurs and lizards tend to have soft eggs. I think even turtle eggs are rather soft. Crocodile eggs are soft, so this is a development by birds. And there's necessary to sit on top of eggs to heat them up and incubate them, keep them at a warm temperature above the environment. I suppose the interesting thing Again, there with males and various a lot of species, the amount of female to males is dependent on the selection of which the eggs are stored, which is a sort of very interesting thing because the way we mammals are determined, the sex is determined purely by the sex chromosome taken on by the sperm. So there must be a way of determining whether male and femaleness by the actual selection, the genetic selection at the very early term in an embryo. This gets us back to another comment about eggs. The chicken and the egg story was a major point, not due to biological points, but due to the term of in ancient Greece, due to the g'day mate, due to the a concern about the idea of eternity. Did things have a beginning or an end? And so there was a large amount of research into chicken and eggs. A major person who researched chicken and eggs was Aristotle, and so apparently his initial claim to fame was researching the problems of chicken and eggs and the discovery of chicken embryos. So our chicken eggs, a chicken and egg story actually, which came first, the chicken and eggs. Well, the story is that the story question of which came first, chicken and eggs, is one of the first things that came the first philosophical question. So Aristotle, apparently his early claim to fame was the understanding of the chicken and egg problems. So it has a philosophical point into chicken eggs, the existence of and creation and all those sorts of questions come into it. And indeed, had religious impact. The chicken and egg question had a religious impact in the in Christian arguments discussing the impact of Aristotle, the great thinker, and oh, I think he was called the great thinker by St. Thomas Aquinas. It's one of those big group of Christians as you come across. Yeah, one of the things is it's quite unusual. Occasionally, I'll go through the garden and you'll come across a soft lizard egg, quite a large egg, and it's sort of really unusual, quite eerie to actually, quite e unusual to actually touch it. So that's dealt with eggs. I suppose another really fascinating thing is that some mammals have evolved or not evolved mammals, a group of not we have marsupials, we've got marsupials, placentals. So you've got things where the actual you're an egg. So I think 12 days after fertilization, you actually form humans form a little eggshell, and that eggshell develops a little bit, then cracks, and then you implant. So we actually go through an egg phase inside your mother, and so the egg forms a shell, flattens out, and part of the cracking of the eggshell is part of the implantation. But there are three regions of the mammals that is that provide milk. Birds don't provide milk to their children. They're birds, they're reptiles. So we've got groups of animals, the large grouping of animals, which is, I think, still a rather artificial thing. It's birds, under vertebrates, that's things with backbones. There's birds, fish, placentals, on my head, oh, amphibians. There's always five in my head. I can't remember what the fifth one. From the top of my head, but under mammals, you've got placentals, which is everything but the kangaroos and wombats, koalas, and monotremes. Now, so, I'm going to talk about the monotremes. There's only two members of monotremes, and they're both members in Australia, and that is the platypus and the echidna. Both of these give birth to eggs. I think they are soft skin eggs, I don't think they're hard. Eggs, so hard eggs is an exclusive preserve of birds. I might be contradicted on it. So both the platypus and the echidna give birth through a single hole, similar to what birds have. So they don't have vaginas, and they give birth to an egg, incubate the egg, and the egg crawls up, the small pup crawls up to a secretion coming out of the fur. So they don't have a dedicated nipple, they have a secretion in their fur and drink the milk from the mother platypus or the mother echidna. Echidna is the name for a equivalent to a hedgehog, probably a bit more hardy than your average hedgehog. And I think hedgehogs are nighttime creatures. Our echidnas at least make their way around during the day, sort of dawn and dusk, and generally see them. Look, they are definitely nocturnal. It comes me back to a night I spent terrified of in army reserve, citizens military force. I could hear this moving about, and then in the morning I got to actually go out and have a look at it, and it was a little group of things. At the front. These are us, what we call spiny anteaters, is an overall term. But back to birds. There's a bird making a huge noise. Interesting here, the just on the sound of birds, the different bird calls in different continents relate to different cultures. So Australian birds have birds have a very have a different culture and tend to actually screech and make pretty awful sounds, except for our famous kookaburras. Also, a bird which is the best mimic bird is the Australian lyrebird, a little blackbird. It's see lots of them at dawn and dusk around here, and they can make a very impressive sounds, even imitating rock songs and car doors slamming, and every other type of bird. They can just go off, and it's a mating call. There's a fantastic one bird which goes on for about 20 minutes, just blowing your mind. I think it's at yeah, it's at Taronga, the bird at Taronga Zoo. This ability to mimic, and this basically gets us onto bird brains and birds intelligence. But this particular bird keeps on going until each time, every time it stops, and it just looks this incredibly sort of angry look. And that's when these tourists, they film it, and they film this bird go on and on and on, and then they can't help it, they just want to replay it in front. They've got the bird in front of them, but they want to replay it on their little mobile phone. And so this they start the bird keeps on going, and then it hears itself from about 10 minutes ago or 3 minutes ago doing it, as these people are going, "Oh, look at it, look at it." And of course it can't stand it. It's amazing thing to see. This is mimicry of birds. We've got a fantastic bird in our garden, which is a satin bowerbird, and they've got heaps of antics, but in making a bower, which is a little I suppose hallway with the arrangement of blue and yellow beads and stuff like that, including a lot of blue telephone wires from the local hapless Telstra Telecom group, which is going around, and they just get raided by blue wires. In fact, the telecom companies invest quite a lot of money putting out the various cables and stuff like that to see which gets attacked by or doesn't get attacked by birds. And there's these cases. I've got these big white self-crested cockatoos coming over here. For some reason, people have these apparently sheds in Melbourne, which or gazebos, and birds just take offence to it and actually just rip it apart. It's quite amazing thing. So this, I've just got in front of me a self-crested to the size of a fairly large chicken, which brings me back to the point of chickens. So we've got the chicken wing in front of us. Now this is very useful to dissect. to move the skin. Oh, again, look, just basically in when you've got school scalpels or non-medical scalpels, they are by definition blunt. Something's blunt, it's not going to cut like a scalpel in a movie. And so what you have to do is you have to decide where you're going to cut and run over that cut 3, 4, 5 times before it comes away, and be very patient cutting over it. So it's, let's say, like a pencil line, it's a light pencil line, but you keep on running over the same one. Now, after you've cut once or two times, it pulls away a little bit and moves across. Then you've got to lift the skin off. Lift the skin off, you have to get tweezers and you have to go see where the ligaments are holding the skin to the bone and actually cut one by one. The muscles then will be held in these beautiful sacks, silky little sacks. And this is an important thing. So if you go in there as a butcher, you don't want to butcher your meat, you want to dissect your meat. And you'll be able to see these beautiful held muscles, which are in opposing pairs, and the muscles are held by these really silky, flat strings. So, if you imagine a string but flattened, these are the ligaments, and the ligaments connect the muscle to the bone. And once you identify the ligaments, you can go in with a pair of surgical scissors. Scalpel's not probably recommended. Cut the ligaments off, and you can observe the ligaments go around. I'm trying to think. I've forgotten the name of the material at the end of the bones. And this is the main idea of these podcasts, is just to really get my brain going again. It's the cartilage. There you go, cartilage. And you can also see, if you're really good, the synovial sacs. This is the lubrication between joint, is in the form of sacs. So there's all these wrapping of filaments of sort of wrapping in sort of silky bags. So this allows, because the bone is in a silky, the muscle is in a silky sac, it can contract and expand without getting tangled, have its blood supply moving across. And you can actually operate your chicken wing once it's taken apart, by pulling on these ligaments. You can orient your chicken wing. One of the most important things here is that the chicken wing has evolved, and the edge of the chicken wing is a claw. These people don't know how long they've been eating chicken for, but they don't realize that there's a claw on the end of the chicken wing. I think a lot of people, a lot of dishes, you remove the claw, but when you're dissecting it, you can see the end of a claw. And you can definitely know this because in Australia you have these predatory look, almost every, no, look, there's probably three birds. There's the mynah birds, that which are the noisy birds that you can often hear going beep beep beep, and they don't attack you unless you pick up one of their chicks. And so what happened recently is that one of their chicks fell out of the nest, and it wasn't me. A friend of my wife's came and put the poor little chick up into the nest, and for some reason it associated it with me, who did, and they have this cluck cluck cluck, and they go at you. And there's also the plover. I think you would have the plover, except the plovers are very dangerous in Australia. Oh. And look, I must admit, they walk around at night and they look like penguins. If you're not sure what they look like, they look like a penguin. If you don't look at them very carefully, I look like a penguin coming past. And they plant, they have their eggs in the middle of ovals, and so there's all this thing. People who run sporting clubs go out there to remove the eggs. It's quite a dangerous thing, and they will definitely attack you. Whereas the most dangerous bird of all is the magpie, and various people, there's sort of eyes lost, and often people in Australia ride around with all these cable ties sticking out of their helmet. And I know various people. One of the things is that a magpie will sweep you if you've got a stick. But if you have a stick on a string and you drag the stick behind you, for some reason they don't swoop. That's true, listen to South Australia. Oh, just so these magpies do swoop, and they do have their little claw on their wing, and they don't actually attack you with the actual beak. You can imagine the beak and so they actually attack. I know this because one came as I was trying to go for an interview for an apartment. Came for an interview apartment. I had blood streaming out my ear because a magpie had actually sideswiped me, and they attack you with the claw on their wings. So all birds have their claw on the wings, which is an interesting aspect. So they've got the hollow bones, which I've discussed before. Another interesting thing is that birds do not have lungs, and birds do not pant. They have a four-sac system, which pushes the air through four separate little breathing sacs. An incredible aspect. And so they're more than twice as per weight, twice as efficient as mammals is breathing. This is why the canaries will die in a mine, because they are breathing twice as much air as humans are. So it's a different breathing mechanism. It's developed by the dinosaurs, and it's thought that the Tyrannosaurus rex, these big dinosaurs with the teeth. Of course, birds do not have teeth, but dinosaurs definitely do have teeth. They do have one tooth, I should say that. Remaining, but birds have this sac breathing system, and again, it's a bit beyond me to describe how it works, but it's an interesting process, and so it's quite often interesting just to watch in Disney animations the actual birds appear to breathe, which is there the actual process of breathing. So you've got the air sacs, the greater efficiency, and they need this efficiency to have the power for a sustained flight. They need to actually extract more oxygen per breath than we can possibly hope to do as humans. Now, so humans, animals have clusters of air sacs. So although we have two lungs, we've got five, two and three clusters of air sacs, or lung segments, again neatly wrapped up. So if you get the lung, you'll see these components. These components is oh, so everything else is pre-wrapped like a supermarket. It's got these membranes keeping the organs nice and separate from each other, so they can rotate and not fall into each other. And of course, snakes have evolved, have lost the two lungs to a single lung, so they don't have as big a chest. You can imagine being a snake; it's a long running things. Birds' beaks, without having, they have one remaining tooth, which is their egg tooth. So birds aren't teethless; they have at least one tooth, which they use to actually break their eggshell from the inside. So the weakness of an eggshell is an egg is they can withstand force, external forces, but an internal force they can relatively easily break. Now the chicken legs, which is a very useful thing to do. If you get your chicken, if you had a live chicken and you were to dissect it, dissecting a chicken leg would be extremely hard because they're covered with dinosaur scales. That's right. So the dinosaurs were covered with scales, and the scales are essentially fingernails, the same keratin, I think it's called, a hair-like molecule. But the chicken legs have to be heat treated in boiling water for the keratin to be removed. This is if you buy chicken legs, they've got the actual all over dinosaur scales removed, and this is the process. Again, a lot of people don't know this because they've only ever bought or seen chicken legs and don't understand that they're covered with scales. Now, chicken legs are very Useful again to dissect and pull out. This time is that you flip them over at the top end and cut them out, and you will expose a like a full dimensioned cable of about five, possibly more, tendons all laid on top of each other. So if you imagine you've got a ribbon, and you've got some tendons are ribbons, so tendons connect the muscles to the bone, and ligaments connect the bone to the bone to bone. So that is basically we're puppets on a string. That's ex essentially what we are. Getting back to the jigging dissection just for a second. We go back to that, and the important thing is to remove the bone, the muscles, and have them in pairs, a bit like a fighter bomber. You actually have them in pairs, nice, ready to go, with the observation of this sort of silky sheen. And at the end of it, you will have just the bones by itself, but the bones will be stuck together, a bit like a skeleton evolved, but the ligaments. Holding everything together, see how things are going. It takes a lot of skill to actually dissect a chicken. But going back to dissecting a chicken leg, if you uncut the, if you cut the top skin away, you can pull out the various ligaments, and ligament by ligament, you pull and manipulate the individual claws from each other, and you can actually get your reanimate your chicken leg by actually pulling the ligaments at a distance. And this fascinates children for a while, and they begin to understand. And then you point out the fact that the same thing is going in your hand. Your fingers don't have heaps of muscles, but they do have the ability to apply force, and the force is from muscles further up, even to your arm, which pulls the ligaments away. The important thing is that the there are in a bird anchored ligaments, that is ligaments which are basically automated due to the orientation of the leg. So if the leg falls, it's pushed backwards. Basically, the birds have this perching mechanism that as if their legs are pushed up. Basically, if a bird perches its legs, its claws close, i.e., if it's on a branch and it sits and its weight goes downwards, the legs automatically close. So they have a locking mechanism, which is their weight of the bird falling off the branch is sufficient for it to lock onto the branch. And of course, this is a little bit more difficult. There are various birds which basically cannot do not spend their time on the ground. They spend their time on branches. And again, the difficulty of birds actually or rather than hopping. So I suppose you've got the you should observe birds walking or hopping and see how the actual birds actually walk because or orient because the their talons will close as they raise their body, they retract their legs upwards. It's a perching process. That's about covered all general things to do with birds. There's also feathers and a whole heap of other aspects that you can talk about. The interesting thing there is the fact that a general knowledge comes from a general discussion. So I've had general discussions with the people with it. I suppose this the curiosity is, I suppose, people having a preconception of putting themselves into birds' bodies. I think that might be it. There's this cultural thing about where people transform into birds, and that transformation is sort of just very much like putting on a bird costume. That's that general level of misconceptions. But the general idea here is that the ability to have general broad-ranging discussions which take people into different areas of science and before evolution, before the fossil records, people didn't actually question where birds came from and how they fitted in and what they said to us about our environment and history, i.e. Having survived the asteroid impact and having features of dinosaurs and being effectively dinosaurs. I think that was a big drum roll about 10 years ago, that birds are in fact dinosaurs. It's more our cultural idea of birds being sort of a witness to our daily life, that sort of cultural view, interferes with education, and that education, which is purely book-induced, is sort of limiting the way that you could go, the ability to have general discussions. A final thing is about chickens, is that chickens have reached peak chicken, apparently. There's a large number of chickens on Earth, but the actual flock, the worldwide flock, is reached a certain level. I'll have to check that out. I don't know whether we're approaching peak chicken or we've reached peak chicken. And chickens are an incredibly environmentally friendly way of providing the world with cheap, reproducible meat. There's all the ethical stuff of the way we keep chickens, and chickens could well be the death of all of us, as the keeping of large internal flocks in small areas are perfect breeding grounds for rapid production of bird flu, which can kill us, or the fact that to keep our chicken flock healthy, we are feeding them full of antibiotics, and with antibiotics we're making immune superbugs by feeding the chickens with these large amounts of antibiotics. So there are all those other aspects of it. That about exhausts all the top of my head facts I have about chickens and birds. And it's more a display of just flowing threads of different ideas together. You can cover a lot of different topics. Thanks for listening. This is Peter Hill Explains.